Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on Air. On tonight's program, with Ebola on everyone's mind, we'll find out how our community is preparing and if we're ready.
We have a guidance document, sort of a playbook we've developed. I think last week it got updated almost twice daily.
Plus, the consequences of inflammatory bowel disease in children.
The incidence of Crohn's disease is increasing, and the growth mainly is under the age of 12, which is worrisome.
And a rebroadcast of an interview with a pioneer in women's health, Dr. Richard Aubrey, who recently passed away.
It's impossible to be pessimistic when you're seeing new life created and brought into reality. So I think that's probably the biggest effect on me, it said.
We'll get a checkup from the neck up and hear a selection from our healing muse. That's all coming up right after the news. Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we explore inflammatory bowel disease in children and how it can have serious consequences for growth and development. Plus, in memoriam, we'll listen again to Dr. Richard Aubrey's reflections on a 50-year career in women's health. But first, with Ebola on everyone's mind, we'll learn what Upstate University Hospital, newly designated as a regional center by the governor, is doing to be ready. With the two Dallas nurses becoming infected with Ebola after caring for Thomas Eric Duncan, the first man to die from the disease in the U.S., the fear of Ebola has taken this country by storm. Hospitals and health facilities around the country have begun rigorous assessment of their own readiness and infectious control protocols. We'll hear with more on this is Christopher Dunham. He's the Emergency Management Director for Upstate Medical University and University Hospital. Welcome, Chris. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So first, help us understand or better understand what we really now know about the transmission of Ebola. You know, when is it infectious and who may be at risk?
Well, what we know now is a sort of an extension of what we've always known. It's not airborne, and there's been a lot of panic surrounding this. It's bloodborne or contact precautions, in other words, body fluids. Evidenced in Dallas, the people living with the original patient wound up being free from Ebola. So there is a transmission rate that they currently look at, but it's not always 100%.
So the point is, you are only infectable, that's the other question. When is it infectious? In other words, a person can have it in their body.
Yeah, for quite a while. Yeah, typically the incubation period goes from anywhere from 8 to 21 days. And if you are what the term is asymptomatic or not having any symptoms such as fever, flu-like symptoms, things like that, typically you're not contagious. The moment you start getting a fever or getting those other symptoms, which are on the CDC website and our website as well, you can go ahead and consider yourself, that would be when they consider people contagious.
Right, then they're infectious
right.
to others, but only
if,
but if somehow their bodily fluids mm-hmm. come into contact with someone else's skin
yep.
or some way of getting into the other person's
correct.
Body.
Correct.
Does the Ebola protocol that is that you undertake right now, does it differ from other infectious disease protocols? And if so, in what way?
I think it differs in two major respects. Number one is the level of mortality with it necessitates a large degree of training and a large use of personal protective equipment for our own staff safety. Certainly, personal protective equipment is sort of the day-in and day-out usage for all of our clinical staff. But with Ebola, especially given what's happened recently, we've really amped it up and exceeded CDC guidelines for Upstate almost since the beginning of this sort of event in the United States.
So the point is, because it's so virulent, because it's such a killer,
yes,
it's that much more serious in a way.
Correct. And other things are certainly not less serious, but the chances you take are greater to some extent, and certainly there isn't a magic time frame where someone can be around somebody who has Ebola where you may not get it. You know, there is no magic foot rule in terms of, 5 feet, 10 feet, whatever.
Oh, I see. That's interesting too. So, you know, I know that they've been the country has been kind of rocked by these two nurses mm-hmm. being infected, and so the government has stepped up and appointed this new Ebola czar mm-hmm. recently. How do you think what will the public see that will be different as a result of this?
My sincere hope is better communications from the federal government level, especially in the CDC, on changes through what they're trying to do or attack or support local communities or local healthcare institutions. Also, I believe there would be at least a clear chain of command in terms of less duplication of resources, better use of physicians and healthcare teams. Also, and I know the CDC has recently come out with, they're starting to, let's say a hospital in the Midwest would have somebody who would be a highly suspected case. They would actually send a team of physicians and nurses and infectious disease experts to that location to help them out. And during the initial stages of the Dallas event, I don't think they had that for quite some time.
So they have kind of an emergency team.
Yeah, kind of a go team.
Yeah.
Yeah, which would be great. I mean, that's a big help.
The other thing is that I think you may not even have the answer to this because I haven't been able to find it, but it's been alluded to throughout the last several weeks in terms of how the country will handle subsequent cases of Ebola. I mean, is there a sense that they're going to, you know, I know we have these four centers
right.
that are very highly skilled. I mean, they've done it many, many, many times.
For years.
And then we have the rest of our 5,000 hospitals and health centers throughout the country that haven't, obviously, however well prepared they may think they are. So I guess the question is, have they come up with an idea as to what's going to happen to cases that may happen somewhere away from these four centers?
No, there's just nothing official that's been communicated as of yet. As it stands right now, these four centers have these infectious disease units, and they train rigorously, and this is pretty much all they train to do. We're certainly preparing for that and upping our training, but there's been no official word that a patient in Syracuse would automatically go to one of these four centers, although I'm sure at that point nothing is off the table.
Yeah, they're still working out
yep.
these details, I know, because it's been alluded to, and I've mm-hmm. heard some of the national figures talking about it, that we would maybe bring, and they have brought
yeah.
these two nurses to centers. That
yeah,
kind
it
of
was
thing.
Very telling for me for those two nurses to go to those centers.
Rather than being left
exactly.
in Dallas.
Exactly, yeah. or at another facility.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Christopher Dunham. He's Emergency Management Director for Upstate Medical University and University Hospital. We're talking about Ebola and what is being done to prevent its spread. Well, locally in New York State, recently, Governor Cuomo designated Upstate University Hospital, I guess, as one of eight hospitals in the state to handle patients diagnosed with the Ebola virus. Well, what does that mean when you get a hospital designation of that kind?
For us, it's an opportunity to expand our capabilities. We're actively training and dedicating separate space to take care of these patients. But also, it helps our regional partners to have them, if they have a suspected case or a highly suspected case or a clinically confirmed case, to actually transport them to us for further care and treatment. And it's a way of hospitals to link together and work together a little more efficiently.
Now, the truth is, for years, you have been doing drills. I mean, there was SARS at one
yes.
point. There was the threat of bioterrorism at one point.
H1N1.
H1N1
yeah.
came by, and avian flu. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about these kinds of things, plus natural disasters. So I know you've had disaster or emergency management
Oh, yes.
things in place.
Oh, yeah, for
how
quite a
while. So how is that changing, or how is it different in this particular climate?
For us, we've actually looked yearly at sort of identifying our top five risks. And since I can remember, number two or three on the list, no matter when it was always pandemic/epidemics. And it's always something that we've identified as a very big drain on resources, on personnel, on equipment, on everything. And that's how we kind of look at emergency management. It can be a very small event, but it could have a very big impact on the facility. So trying to mitigate that impact is what we try to do. Now, for Ebola, the resources in terms of separation, staff dedication, and sort of keeping everything as safe as possible for our staff is paramount. It also creates some unique logistical issues.
Like what? Help us understand
that. we've exceeded CDC guidelines for the personal protective equipment for quite some time now. And every time, I think it was recently, they updated it.
Yeah, they just recently came out mm-hmm. and said now no skin can
right.
show.
Right. And we've had that in process for quite a while, but we've added parts and pieces to that equipment to further enhance that. In other words, we want to make that equipment as simple as possible for our folks to get in and out of and as safe as possible. The more complex it is, the worse, the more likely somebody would make a mistake taking it off.
Absolutely.
So as we do that, we try to buy more things or procure more things, and we're finding that there's national shortages on PPE right now. Certainly there's a lot that's been sent over to West Africa. So that creates some logistical issues that we've been able to overcome, but it's been kind of a challenge for us. Also, we need to take a good look at these patients because the mortality rate is so high in most instances. You know, clinically, this offers some dynamic things that need to be, that are currently being worked on. And also, what do you do with the waste when somebody comes into one of these hospitals?
That even, was a good question asked.
Even the sheets they sleep on, you know, that cannot just simply be thrown out. All those things have been addressed and are currently being worked out. And we're actually aggressively, what I like to call drilling it or testing it, see if it works, see where, you know, we do a lot of dry runs and okay, what do we do ifs and things like that.
Yeah, I'm just going to ask you this. So can you help us understand, so what is supposed to happen if somebody walked into the emergency department today and they had, they felt sick and they had traveled to West Africa recently? What's supposed to happen?
All patients that arrive in our facility will be asked some very important questions when they come in. The first and foremost is, you know, have you traveled to West Africa and have you had any contact with anybody who's been clinically diagnosed with Ebola? Those things are pretty much standard. We make sure the priority here is identification and safe handling of that patient and protection of our staff. So let's say that patient does get identified. They get moved to an isolation room, separated from everybody else as quickly as possible. And then the wheels start going where we integrate with the local county emergency management, Onondaga Department of Health, and then we also go to the State Department of Health and the CDC, and we start relying on them as well for other resources. But we have a process within the hospital that once that person is identified by those three simple questions, that a lot of things get brought to bear to ensure the safety of everybody else in the room and to also make sure we provide good quality patient care for that patient.
So it sounds to me that you have a tremendous responsibility now in terms of all the different levels of training. I mean, it's even the registration people
yes.
alone,
yeah.
which would be basically the front line,
sure.
need to recognize the potential for somebody to walk in with a problem.
Yeah, we've done a tremendous amount of training so far. In just the registration piece alone, in our what I would call our frontline staff, they've all done through initial training, awareness level training. They've actually drilled this yesterday. And we're not just talking about the hospital. All of our outpatient clinics, all of our associated people that we work with, all the doctor's offices, we've tried to reach out and provide as much information as we can at the moment and to do that as accurately as possible.
Would you say the protocol is the same whether the patient is adult or pediatric?
The pediatrics is kind of the big question right now. There isn't a tremendous amount of information out there. The protocol is relatively the same. In other words, the isolation and things like that. The wild card for us is if you have a pediatric patient, the family is a huge consideration because certainly if you have a 3-year-old pediatric patient, you can't necessarily separate them from mom and dad relatively easily. So there's some considerations and some things we're looking into. But pediatrics is, surprisingly, there's not a lot of data coming out of West Africa regarding that at the moment. So we're currently pursuing
it.
Yeah, we're pursuing that.
This is a work in progress, obviously, for everyone. Continuously.
For the past 10 days, I mean, we have a guidance document, sort of a playbook we've developed. And I think last week it got updated almost twice daily.
Yeah.
So it's been constant revision.
Well, you and the CDC and the NIH and what's happening with WHO, I mean, everywhere.
Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of people clinically and non-clinically that have been working on this at Upstate.
So with all of the things, are you also involved in educating first responders?
Not yet, but we've definitely shared our communications with them. And right now it's about information sharing mode. And certainly we like to work with our local EMS partners and give them anything they need.
And the staff are being trained to use these PPEs correctly. And in the case, I think, in Texas, there was some concern about how they used them.
Right.
So that they're being trained to use them properly and to really maintain right. that high level of care.
We've identified the staff that would deal with that patient. So we don't have to train everybody. We just, we're focusing on the people who would actually care for the patient.
So in summary, would you say that you're ready?
Absolutely. We're as ready as we can be right now. And we're going to get better as the weeks go on.
Well, I appreciate your coming in. I think that gives us all a lot of peace of mind. I appreciate your being here. My guest has been Christopher Dunham, the Emergency Management Director for Upstate Medical University and University Hospital. Once again, thanks for joining us, Chris.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Next up, how inflammatory bowel disease in children can have serious consequences to their growth and development. Up to 2 million Americans suffer from inflammatory bowel disease, also known as IBD. And although people of all ages are diagnosed with IBD, it's recently become one of the most significant chronic diseases affecting children and adolescents. We'll hear with more on this challenging problem is Dr. Pratik Wali, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics and the Interim Division Chief of Gastroenterology and Nutrition at Upstate Medical University. Welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Linda.
So let's begin for our listeners by defining inflammatory bowel disease syndrome. What exactly is it?
Well, inflammatory bowel disease is actually not a syndrome. It is a true disease. It comprises ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. Both of these diseases are autoimmune, which means that your immune system attacks your intestines. And once it turns on, it doesn't turn off.
What's the difference between these two parts of IBD, the Crohn's disease? Help us understand the difference between Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. How are they different? How are they the same?
Well, ulcerative colitis mainly affects the colon. Crohn's disease can affect anywhere in the GI tract. That's the big difference between the two. Kids with ulcerative colitis usually present with rectal bleeding, belly pain, weight loss. Kids with Crohn's disease usually present with weight loss and belly pain. Some kids in either can have mouth sores, swollen joints, and it really affects their life.
And when you talk about it's an autoimmune disease and you say your own immune system turns against your own body, do we have any idea what causes these kinds of things to develop?
We aren't exactly sure, but we know it's an interaction between the environment, your genetics, and your immune system. There's over 100 genes so far that have been linked, however, not one particular gene.
Does it seem to run in families?
It does. It does. You do have a higher chance, but that doesn't mean that the children will have inflammatory bowel disease necessarily.
So tell me what the symptoms look like. You made some allusion. Are they similar in ulcerative colitis to Crohn's, or are they different? I mean, what kinds of things?
They do have similar symptoms. Usually the weight loss and malnutrition is greater in Crohn's disease. And in ulcerative colitis, usually rectal bleeding is more of a symptom.
Now, we were talking about that it's a growing problem in children and adolescents. Are there any hypotheses as to why it seems to be happening?
No, we don't know why it's increasing, but there's clear increase, especially in Crohn's disease around the world. The incidence of Crohn's disease is increasing, and the growth mainly is under the age of 12, which is worrisome.
Wow, so it's increasing largely in children.
Yes.
What percentage would you say, and I know I'm asking you this off the fly, but what percentage of people with IBD are children or adolescents versus the general?
Sure. That's 20% of inflammatory bowel disease presents in childhood. And in childhood, the disease is usually more aggressive.
So what is that the main difference between the two when you say, I mean, how does it present itself that's different in childhood as opposed to in an adult?
Well, there's two very big differences between children and adults.
Just small adults.
That's right. The two big differences are growth and bone health. Children with IBD often have very poor growth. Almost 85% present with poor growth. Because of that, we tend to treat more aggressively to restore health, restore their growth. They also have a pediatric endocrinologist that helps them with their bone. And we have a pediatric nutritionist that helps with the diet.
So the bottom line is, it's not so much that the disease is different in children or adults, it's the ramifications of the disease in a growing entity as opposed to someone who's already achieved their full height, their full, you know, developmental stature.
It's both. I think you have it right. It's more aggressive in childhood, and there's greater ramifications.
Well, I want to get to more about the ramifications in a couple minutes, but obviously, if your child is having these kinds of symptoms and you get diagnosed, well, first of all, let me go back to that. How are these diagnosed? How is the distinction made that this is not just stomach aches kind of thing and that someone has either Crohn's or ulcerative colitis in childhood?
Sometimes there's signs on blood work. I think once they see our office or our pediatric gastroenterologist, often if we're suspicious, we do what's called an upper and lower endoscopy, otherwise known as a colonoscopy. That's done here at Upstate in the pediatric operating room. And that's really where you get the diagnosis of the two diseases.
And how is that, through samples of tissue, or do they just by visualizing what's going on inside of the colon or the intestines?
Both. We visualize during the actual procedure, and also we take samples that are like the tip of a pen. And those under a microscope give us an idea of which disease process we're dealing with.
So when you're if you're diagnosed with this disease, obviously when you talk about growth and bone difficulties, as you mentioned earlier, it's largely because nutrition has to be compromised, I would think. If your intestines and your colon are compromised, you're not absorbing perhaps? I mean,
the
source?
It's multifactorial. One, you have some difficulty in malabsorption. Two, you have difficulty where you're not taking enough calories because you don't feel well. And the third thing is there's newer studies coming out that your body makes what are called cytokines, which are inflammatory markers that affect your growth directly and also affect the way you feel.
So it has it's multifactorial.
That's
in
right.
Terms of how it affects your development. So what do you do for it medication-wise?
Well, there's a variety of medications, and they're changing every year.
Are there effective medications, I guess?
Absolutely. More and more effective every year. We start with some of the basics, like 5-ASAs.
And what are those?
They're an aspirin derivative, and they're topical. You take them by mouth, but they open up in the intestine. In the past, steroids were very popular. However, we try to limit steroids because they affect growth. Some of the other drugs are immunomodulators, and the new drugs are called biologics. That would be infliximab and adalimumab, both which have been shown to be very effective in especially Crohn's disease.
And what exactly do they do?
They bind some of these inflammatory cytokines that we were talking about.
And so they minimize the symptoms, or do they actually help with the entire underlying process?
They minimize the symptoms, but they also affect the actual disease process. So they take away the swelling.
If you're just listening to us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with pediatric gastroenterologist Dr. Pratik Wali, and we're talking about inflammatory bowel disease in children. So do things like probiotics or any kind of nutritional therapy help as well? In other words, if you change your diet or if you remove stress from a child, do those play a role?
That's a complicated question. Stress does not play a role in this disease process, but stress definitely makes treating it very difficult. Stress usually has been linked to irritable bowel syndrome, which sometimes gets mixed up with inflammatory bowel disease.
And that's often, in terms of acronyms, that's called IBS.
That's right.
And this is IBD, and you could understand why someone might make that mistake.
Exactly.
But the point is that stress is not the crucial factor here, but can dietary changes or the use of probiotics make a difference?
Actually, it's interesting. Something we do differently at Upstate than other places around the country is offer what's called enteral therapy, which means that you can go on a formula for 90% of your calories, and it also works to put the disease in remission. It's something that's done commonly around the world, but not commonly in the U.S.,
That's unfortunate. So, but it's nice to know that that's happening here in our region. Tell us about surgery. I know that for some of these diseases, surgery is the preferred or a preferred treatment. Which of those, Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, when would you recommend surgery?
Well, years ago, surgery was up to 80% of children that had either Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. Now, with improving medications, we're looking at less than 20%, and really less than 10% with the new biologics. In general, surgery is more of an option with ulcerative colitis because it is curative to take out the colon. In Crohn's disease, we try to avoid surgery. We try to maximize medications and minimize the number of exacerbations we have.
Do you find the children, once they start on these kinds of medications and or have surgical intervention, do they require, well, let's go back to the medication, do they require these medications lifelong, or do they eventually grow out of this problem?
This is a chronic disease process. Therefore, you don't grow out of it. You do require some type of medications for maintenance to keep yourself, yes, in remission. Now, it's hard to say lifetime because there's new drugs coming out every year. So in 5 years, this might be a different landscape.
That's very interesting. So are you thinking that some of these new drugs can actually cure these kinds of autoimmune problems?
We definitely hope that there will be a cure in the future. But the newer drugs at least are getting closer and closer to targeting the molecules that are really involved.
So you were alluded, I'm particularly interested to something you said earlier when it comes to children and how it's different and how it can affect development. Tell me a little bit more about some of the things you've seen in terms of how the development of children's development is affected.
Well, there's growth, definitely. Like I said, both linear growth and weight are affected.
So are they generally smaller and leaner?
Yes, definitely.
So they don't necessarily suffer from the same problems that a diabetic child might in terms of childhood obesity.
That's right.
So they're generally leaner and smaller.
They're leaner, they're smaller, and it takes a little while after being on therapy for them to grow. Therefore, a pediatric nutritionist is a must.
So what are some of the psychosocial issues that are surrounding these patients? In other words, how does it affect their relationship to others, their success in school, all those kinds of things?
Well, we try to really focus in on how their quality of life is. And a lot of these children have depression and anxiety, dealing with a chronic disease at an early age. So we try to get our psychology colleagues involved. And also we offer something different at Upstate, which is pediatric hypnosis, which helps to use imagery and biofeedback to help relax them. It might not actually treat the problem, but it treats the psychosocial issues that come with this.
So the bottom line is that, well, let me ask you this. Do they have things like diarrhea as a secondary issue or difficulty, you know, urgency and things that might embarrass them, put them in a really socially embarrassing situation as part of this?
Absolutely. And really, that's more important to a lot of these children than anything else. And so we have to try to minimize the diarrhea, the embarrassment, the urgency as much as we do everything else.
So bottom line, what are you doing here? You're alluding to, in various ways, what you do at your Upstate clinic. What types of things are you doing that are different, as you mentioned? Can you summarize those?
Well, we have started a pediatric IBD center of excellence, which means we have 4 pediatric gastroenterologists, and we're going to have 5 soon. We have 4 GI nurses, and we'll have 5 soon. We have our own pediatric nutritionist. We have 2 pediatric radiologists, one of them who specializes in MRI, especially for inflammatory bowel disease. Dr. Rivera and I are both trained in small intestine capsule, which is pretty interesting.
Which means?
It's a camera that you swallow that takes 50,000 pictures as it goes down, and then it comes together as a video of your intestine.
It's a way of diagnosing and keeping track of how the intestine is doing.
Yeah, especially in the tough cases where the disease is in places where we don't have the ability to get to with scope.
So it sounds like you're really, it's a multidisciplinary team, and you have quite a wide variety of resources here.
We do, and you have to deal with this with the multidisciplinary team because there's a lot of issues with children with inflammatory bowel disease, and we want to get them as healthy as possible.
And is there support also for the parents? In other words, education and support?
There are a couple of good resources that we like to refer to. There's gastrokids.org and the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation, ccfa.org. Both of them have excellent information on both the medications and some of the deeper definitions of the two disease processes.
We'll make sure to put a link to those on our website. And you're going to have some annual conferences?
We are. We're trying to help with education and teaching for parents so that they feel more comfortable. So we're going to have an annual teaching night where we bring in some speakers and we talk about some of the topics that are involved and some of the newer therapies that are here.
Well, it sounds wonderful. I want to thank you so much, especially with this growing problem. It's wonderful to see that you've kind of stepped up and put together this very, very important team. My guest has been Dr. Pratik Wali. He's Assistant Professor of Pediatrics and the Interim Division Chief of Gastroenterology and Nutrition at Upstate Medical University. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Lynn.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up. Four good beauties, or if not now, when? Well, folks, you know how babies are naturally tuned in and connected to other people, and how it's so wonderful to be with them, and how they lose some of that as we socialize them? Well, researchers have found a simple way to regain some of that infectious connection to other people and the positive feelings that go along. They asked people to spend a minute recalling the three longest social interactions that day. Then they rated them on the following, from 1 to 7. I felt in tune with the other person or people around me. I felt close to the person or people. Just doing that daily for a few weeks led to an increased connection to other people and to more positive feelings in their lives overall. And it even led to positive changes in people's heart functioning, something called better vagal tone. Cool, huh? And it might be because just doing this rating, people are inspired to behave differently, to tune in more and connect more positively. So I've been trying this out in my same old life to make new joy, new joy. And as some of you know, my mom is 97, has Alzheimer's, and lives in a nursing home. I was lunching with her, trying to tune in while swimming with her in our current of words and actions that don't make much sense, I bet, to either of us. Then she looks at the table next to us with a fellow resident with Alzheimer's and three younger women visiting, possibly her daughters, and she says, "Look, Richie, four good beauties, each one of them. Four good beauties." With my new tune connect attitude, I thought, I'll go tell them. I worried for a second that they might think I was trying to hit on all four of them at once, but I swept that aside with, "All right, so what? If not now, when?" I jump up and say, "Be back in a minute," 3 or 4 times, of course, because Mom is almost deaf, and go over. Two of the women I'd never met, and the third is indeed the daughter. I say, "My mom said to tell you four good beauties at that table. Each one of them, four good beauties." First, puzzled looks. Then, "Oh, isn't that lovely? Thank you for sharing that with us." And daughter, for sure, turns to my mom and says, "Thank you, Lita. That is so sweet of you." Mom gets the music, if not the words, and just lights up. She toddles over scarily and kisses her fellow resident on top of the head, just beaming, connecting to all the beaming smiles and the lovely tone of voice. All of us just lit up. Now, I don't know if my vagal tone got better, but definitely new joy, and very heartwarming. If you want to know more, check out the book Love 2.0, Creating Health and Happiness in Moments of Connection by psychologist Dr. Barbara Fredrickson, or visit the website positivityresonance.com. I'm Dr. Rich O'Neill. Thanks for, guess what, tuning in.
Coming up, we'll listen again to an interview with a pioneer in women's health in Central New York, Dr. Richard Aubrey, in memory of his recent passing. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Welcome back to HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen with your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of October 27th. Get your game on. A workout doesn't have to feel like work. People who engage in entertaining social activity are more likely to stick to it in the long term. So try to add some fun to your fitness. Fly a kite, dance around the room, or start a family football game, or play a backyard game of catch. Anything to get moving. Stay fit this week by coming up with two entertaining ways to exercise. Try recruiting friends, family, and coworkers, or check out listings for intramural sports at your local community center, college, or place of worship. Include outdoor activity on Halloween for some seasonal fun. And have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. The Upstate Medical University community is deeply saddened at the loss of a true pioneer in the field of women's health. Dr. Richard Arbery has been a mentor to multiple generations of physicians interested in public health, babies' well-being, and safe motherhood. He has been a leader in public health for more than half a century and has trained hundreds of residents and medical students, always with passion and conviction. He was a pioneer in the field of maternal-fetal medicine and helped to shape the direction of medical care in the field of obstetrics and gynecology. Dr. Arbery recently established a fund to help high-risk mothers, and he also left a legacy gift to the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology to endow a professorship in his name. What follows is a recent interview done in May of 2013 when we had the opportunity to sit down with him as he was preparing for his retirement. So you've been practicing obstetrics for 50 years right here in Central New York at Upstate Medical University?
Right.
And you're about to retire, I guess.
Well, I'll be moving on to a professor emeritus position, so I'll still be teaching and doing some quality assurance work, but I think it's time for the younger generation to take on the responsibility.
Well, 50 years is quite a remarkable and full career. In that time period, how many babies do you think you've delivered?
Well, it has to be somewhat of an approximation, but best I can arrive at is over 8,000.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
Wow.
So I've been
That's
really...
That's staggering.
These are wonderful miracles, every single one of them, and... it's been something that really keeps me going.
I'm sure. You know, bringing so many lives into the world, it just has to have impacted on the way you see the world. How do you think it has?
Well, I think it really stokes my inclination to be optimistic. It's impossible to be pessimistic when you're seeing new life created and brought into reality. So I think that's probably the biggest effect on me, it's had.
Wow. And you started here, you said earlier before we started talking, in 1963. So lots of things have to have changed. Can you tell us about some of those changes?
Oh, it's really tumultuous change. Probably for hundreds of years, maternity care was pretty steady, non-medical involvement. But in the last 100 years, there's huge changes. And in the 50 years that I was part of the equation, the developments were really quite dramatic, going all the way from doing much more in-depth technologic interventions while we're trying to retain the family-based natural childbirth baseline aspect of obstetric care. So this has been a real dilemma to try to blend the technology with humanity.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. I mean, you're doing things these days like IVF, freezing of eggs, and at the same time you're trying to create an environment that's almost like a home birth situation. It seems like you're almost flying at odds with those two types of those forces that are intervening.
It is a conflict, but it's a conflict that, like many conflicts, ends up producing heat and light, and you end up making significant improvements. You can really be enlightened by what you see.
Now, I had some statistics that were shared to me prior to your coming that you have taught over 8,000 medical residents, and about 200 medical residents and 16 fellows in maternal fetal medicine. That's a staggering number of people that you have affected in your career.
Well, you hope that you're remembered, of course, for what you taught, and as they apply that knowledge to helping others, it is a reassuring feeling to have the impression that your legacy is going to be with the people you taught to render the kind of care that you think is really important.
What would you like people to think of when they think of your legacy?
Well, that's I guess the thing that I would appreciate mostly is the attention I tried to focus on socioeconomic, cultural, and behavioral aspects of maternal health to improve the outcome of pregnancy. I mean, I think the technologies of diabetes and hypertension and RH disease, and we did wonderful things with that, but we're left now with poor outcomes that are still coming from the poor, the disadvantaged. I think I did really try to focus a lot of my attention on improving the care for the indigent patients, which I think is where it really needed it.
Wow. So as you look forward to retirement at this point, in some ways, well, you're going to maintain connection to the medical school and keep working as an emeritus professor. I mean, are there specific academic or scholarly things you want people to remember you for? I know you published some huge number of articles, 50 scientific publications.
Yes. I think what I'm most proud of is the some of the work I did in the first few decades, where we identified the ability to discover who in the population is at high risk. The idea is that if we knew who's high risk, we could intensify the care and improve the overall outcome of the pregnancy. And I think working with Dr. Nesbitt and some of my other colleagues in the first couple of decades, we were able to do that. And then once we knew how to find who's the high-risk patient, we developed a regional center and a regional program for Central New York that would allow us to give special care to the high-risk patient. So that is a source of great pride.
I'm sure that most of what you've done is a source of great pride. Do you think that we're moving in the right direction in obstetrics? I don't want to run out of time. We've got only a little bit of time left. Or do you think that there is much still to be done?
Well, I think we're headed in the right direction. I'm concerned that we need more attention to the poor and more attention to blending the technology with humanity. But I think there's a great chance that we can achieve this without a problem.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in. You've had such an august career, and you've honored us with your presence today. My guest has been Dr. Richard Arbery. He's the Director of Academic and Community Obstetrics at Upstate Medical University. That was our recent interview done in May of 2013 with Dr. Richard Arbery, who recently passed away, as he completed a distinguished 50-year career in women's health in Central New York. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Well, for most students, a medical education is all-consuming. All the more reason that there's a need to find time for your art. And here with more on this is Karen Howard. She's a fourth-year student in the MD-PhD program at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you.
So, obviously, you and your fellow medical students have felt that there's something else to life than just studying medicine. So you've engaged in some kind of a very interesting undertaking. Tell us about it.
Well, this is the first campus I've been to where I've noticed that there isn't an art club for students, or at least a creative outlet. There used to be a photography club. There isn't one anymore, and I felt that an art club here at Upstate would really benefit the students, so I decided to start one.
So you have an art club you've begun, but are you an artist? Is this something you've been doing throughout your life?
Yes. I specialize in comics myself. I love illustrated storytelling. But there are so many other students on campus who just love to paint, who love watercolors, who love colored pencils. There's a huge variety of art talent at Upstate.
So this was really a need that you met.
Yes.
How many students are involved at this point?
There are around 30 students, and they are from all four colleges at Upstate, so not just the medical students.
So you've got the health-related sciences and all of that. Well, that makes sense. I mean, art cuts across everywhere.
Many
people can be artists and are artists. And recently you just had a show.
Yes. It was our first show, and I was very proud of everyone how it turned out. Since we were a new club, we weren't sure how many people would have work ready for it. But we had the month of April in the Health Sciences Library. 12 students had artwork to show, and some people had, for example, one piece, and some people had four or five. So we had a large variety of works with multiple different media. There were painters, watercolors, photographers. It was great.
And you had clay as well?
Yes.
Pottery? And
we had a sculpture artist.
Wow. So how does it that someone who's so engaged, you're obviously in a very intensive program, it's MD-PhD, so it's a long haul there.
Yes.
How do you find time, or do you find time, to do this?
Well, I like to think that if something's important to you, you make the time for it. And I think I would be less of a scientist, less of a doctor, if I decided to cut this part out of my life. And so I just blame good time management skills.
That's always the answer, but not all of us have it, I guess.
Yeah.
But I guess the other question I have for you is, what role do you think that your art plays overall in your life? I mean, does it inform you as a scientist or as a physician? Will, you know, someday as a doctor? I mean, how do you see the role that it plays?
Well, I think part of being an artist is learning to see. That's what they call it. And artists generally have very good observational skills, which I think are essential to being a good doctor and a good scientist. So I'll have to say, in that respect, art really helps my career.
Do you also think that it gives you a time to maybe be more reflective?
Oh, yes.
Or more introspective, perhaps, than just focusing on kind of getting tasks done?
It brings you down to earth, helps you connect with other people. That's a big part of sharing your art and helping other people make art, making your own art. It definitely reminds you that you are human and you are not a medical machine.
So it's a humanizing experience.
Yes.
And I think too often things like art and music or the arts in general are seen as frivolous sometimes and not seen as important in kind of the development of a whole person or of a culture for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really great that you've seen the need for this and you provided an outlet. So very briefly, in the little time we have left, do you meet on a regular basis? How does this club work?
Well, we just got a room. So I'm going to hopefully start regular meetings, start art projects. We meet at cafes or the libraries, that sort of thing. But
so do you think you'll work collaboratively at any point with some of these other
kids?
We have
done that before the art club. If you look at Mani Yayavi and the wonderful anatomy portraits that he did, there's a lot of collaboration, yes.
So it has, like you said, it's an opportunity to work together. It's an opportunity to be human. It's an opportunity to express yourself. It sounds like overall it's been a very important addition to this campus.
Exactly. I hope so.
Well, I appreciate it. I applaud you for doing it. And thank you so much for coming in, sharing your story, and good luck in your program.
Thank
good
you
luck
very
in your
much.
Art. I'd love to see some of your comics sometime. My guest has been Karen Howard. She is a fourth-year medical student in the MD-PhD program at Upstate Medical University who's just started a very important art club on campus. Thanks again, Karen,
Thank
for
you.
Coming in. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Here is a poem that charts the divide between patient and surgeon in the operating room. Alfred University professor and poet Heather Hallberg Yanda describes the patient's thoughts as she awaits the anesthesia in her poem So Many Masks. This room inherits its severity from the rest of the hospital, or maybe it's the other way around. Even the ghosts have been cleaned away with antiseptics that linger in the nose for days, though you wish for one now, to stand by with a protective hand in yours or a caress to the brow. Surrounding you, a constellation of metal instruments and fluorescent lights. Machinery taps your heart's syllables and lisps your deepest secrets. After the hand washing, the gowns, and so many masks, surgeons arrive. Part the careful air in this operating room so their anonymity can join your own. They speak amongst themselves in tongues you cannot understand, and you notice the separateness that echoes through the spaces around you, the division between you and them. And though you don't like to think of it this way, between business and living. Days ago, driving down McHenry Valley, you startled a deer as she darted into the road. The shriek of your brakes, the blur of her coat caught in your headlights, you were as frightened as she was. Safe on the other side, she watched you recover and continue. You wish for her resilience just now, as you are given your own mask, the air thick inside, accompanied by the dizzying fall into anesthesia's small death.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we explore the dangers of e-cigarettes and some of the newer street drugs threatening our kids. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLink on Air, that's all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can look for us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.